Empower Radio presents The Farkas Files, an exploration of energy, metaphysics, and the paranormal with David Franklin Farkas. The Farkas Files. The truth is in here, somewhere. Here's your host, David Franklin Farkas.
Good evening. Thank you, one and all, for being with us wherever you are, whenever you are. You could be listening anytime. I'm very excited about this week's guest. Laird Scranton has found out some things I've been curious about for a long time, and he's got lots of information about it. So that's a teaser, and now tonight's metaphysical musing, which is very spiritual. It's about houseplants. Some people rescue animals. I rescue houseplants. And that sort of happened over time without my particularly initially looking for it. So, for example, I have a rubber tree plant that's becoming a forest, which was something that students next door were getting ready to throw out at the end of the semester. I was like, no, bring it up here. But some of the, and most of these are old friends. And I had a friend who is very sensitive visit yesterday, and she was like, these are really talkative plants, and they really like you. I was like, yeah, yes, indeed, that's my experience. So I got these long-stemmed, lanky plants that somebody wanted to get rid of because they couldn't figure out how to have them in their living room anymore because they were taking over the windows. And I figured out that I could trim the stems and root them in water and turn them into plants that were more vertical and put support poles up and do a whole bunch of things. And so they've been living that way and getting bigger and bigger. And I was rearranging some of the support for one of them, and the stem broke. So a section of about, I don't know, 14 inches long with, they look like little tiny palm trees with the little palm tree on the top of it, suddenly broke off. And I was very sad about it. I was contrite. I was apologetic. And I knew that I could take that little guy and put him in water for a week or two, and he would root, and I'd be able to put him into the soil again and all of that. But I was just not happy with myself for not being more careful. And so a couple of weeks went by, and I was getting ready to replant this little section in the same pot with the rest of its family, when I noticed that the part that was broken was starting to develop its own growth, its own head. There was a new head of this palm tree-like thing was growing out of the broken part. And we could get into the symbolism of things growing where they're broken, but the thing that struck me was the message for me. I was very upset with myself. I thought I had done something terrible. I hadn't done it intentionally. But there was all this shame that was some voice from my childhood about how bad I was and look what you've done and all this other stuff. And, you know, I did all my letting go things. I did Ho'oponopono. I did all the things one should do to heal yourself when you realize that you're shaming yourself. And then I noticed that it didn't exactly not matter, but there was going to be new growth because of this accidental thing that I did that I thought was a bad thing. Not a bad thing. There's going to be new green stuff in my living room window because of that accident. So how much of our lives are exactly like that? We're busy listening to those voices that told us as children that we're bad, wrong, you know, what are you doing? All the things that, all the shaming that was done because the adults basically were afraid of something or didn't want us to be bad, whatever it was. And we carry that around with us, and we can do all our good stuff. But the thing we miss, because all of that is running in the background, is that often these little events that seem to have no meaning and that we judge ourselves for really are an opportunity for new growth. And in this case, that was true literally. So talk to your plants. They love it. And pay attention to the things that you say to yourself that aren't true anymore. So that's tonight's metaphysical musing. And now, let's talk to Laird Scranton. Thanks so much for being on the show, Laird.
Oh, thanks a lot for inviting me on. I've been looking forward to this all week.
Good. It's always nice to be that
for somebody. Of course, I can tell because from the outset, you have, you know, there are two keys to success in this field of this line of work. One is having three names, which you've got. I don't. The other is adopting a signature hat, which I also don't have. So anytime I find somebody who has one of those two things, I know I'm working with a professional.
There you go. Well, the three names thing happened because the internet grew and there were more and more David Farkases online.
Originally, I tell people not to mistake me for all the other Laird Scrantons.
Exactly. So I wound up just to maintain some kind of identity at all online. I took back my middle name. So Laird, your most recent book is Point of Origin. And the little bit that I understand of your work is you have found the point in ancient civilization where everything starts, where all the symbols and the language and the creation stories, and you can tell us what all else, seem to have one point of origin, and then it expands out into all of the ancient world. And I just find that so exciting.
It is a pretty interesting circumstance.
Right. Well, how did you even wind up, you know, you mentioned that you were dragged into it, but how did you wind up doing this work?
Well, it was really just very, very circumstantial. My wife had read a book about mysteries. Every chapter was called, Unexplained by Jerome Clark. And each chapter in the book referred to some unsolved mystery in the world. And one of those chapters was focused on an African tribe called the Dogon, who seemed to know some things about astronomy they shouldn't know. It's a primitive, modern-day primitive tribe. Mm-hmm. They knew things about the stars of Sirius. They knew there were two stars there, more than one star there. And they knew the correct orbital period for two of those stars, things that they shouldn't be able to know without equipment. And so I thought, well, wow, wherever that leads is going to be interesting. And so I started looking into it and keeping notes for myself, and the notes just grew and grew and grew and grew, and I kept trying to keep them organized in some way so I could find a reference if I was looking for it, and sort of accidentally ended up writing a book. And then decided to self-publish that book. The self-published book ended up finding John Anthony West, the Egyptologist, and he took it to publishing fairs in New York and linked me up with Inner Traditions as a publisher. And now 8 or 9 books have been published, and there are more waiting to go. Point of Origin is really not the most recent book it's just about. There's been the one follow-on to Point of Origin called The Mystery of Scarabray that moved on to the UK, but it links directly to the same material. The point of view of the, how can I say this? My field of study is called comparative cosmology. What I'm doing is I'm taking those symbols that Jung saw as archetypes, and I'm trying to learn more about what the symbols mean, what certain myths and rituals mean, by comparing how different cultures understand the same symbol or myth. And so when you have 2 or 3 or 4 cultures all talking about the same issue, you can sort of triangulate it on what the meaning, the original meaning must have been of that thing. This is sort of the way that they reconciled multiple versions of Shakespeare's plays back in the day when every 2-bit publisher was publishing a version. So I'm doing the same thing with ancient cosmology. And the Dogon, the African tribe, who are in Mali and the sort of the hump of Africa, Northwest Africa, their tradition is a fortuitous one to have started with because it has connections to at least 3 major ancient traditions. They've got rituals like Judaism, and they've got civic traditions like ancient Egypt, and they have a symbolic cosmology that's a lot like Buddhism. And they express a lot of this in using ancient Egyptian words that went out of use, you know, in 750 BC. So it's a really lucky starting point. And then over time, I've sort of evolved a set of comparative references so that when I can verify that Dogon words mean a particular thing by comparing to an Egyptian dictionary, I can,
right.
I can verify that a Dogon concept means something by comparing it to what Buddhism says. And there are, you know, half a dozen to a dozen different cross-referencing types of comparisons that can be made here to hold me on track. So the Dogon say that in ancient times, they were specifically taught concepts of creation that outwardly look like science. You can lay it right next to modern science and demonstrate the same way that a child can recite an alphabet, the Dogon can recite the stages of matter from waves to atoms. And what they recite
wow.
is right. And the drawings wow. they make to go with the stages are correct. They line up with the diagram that goes with, you know, modern description. This is very intuitive stuff. It can't be proved, but you lay it side by side and you have an intuitive match.
Which always, I found that in all kinds of things. My usual focus is shamanism and indigenous spirituality. And you find the same kinds of things, you know, across cultures all over the world. They will talk about the same kinds of things in almost the same language with similar symbols, which to me is very encouraging, you know, that is one of the primary understandings of how things work.
Right. And then there have been lots of different perspectives on why that might happen. I mean, you could imagine that two cultures that whose primary building material is stone, it's only a matter of time before they figure out to build a pyramid, stack them up and make a pyramid. How many things can you do with stone, right? So some people see this as being parallel development. But it's finding the compelling argument that says that it can't be parallel development. There's symbolism that you find worldwide with a pyramid that isn't intuitive. It's not obvious. It doesn't come out of simply the choice to stack up those stones. You know, that it's not obvious that it should represent the womb of a woman lying on her back. It's not obvious that the faces of the pyramid should be associated with star groups that regulate the agricultural cycle.
Right.
So there's something more going on here than just parallel development. Now, the Dogon say that in ancient times, they received deliberate instruction in science, basically a civilizing plan. The goal of the civilizing plan was to teach them agriculture. And that civilizing plan was tagged to a creation tradition, that was the symbolic creation tradition, the one that includes all these archetypes that Jung talks about. And things were linked in mnemonic ways so that the way that you wove a cloth recreated a certain function of a process of creation. The way that you plowed a field related back to the cosmology. There's cross-referencing here. So you learn it once and you apply it more than once.
Right.
So years ago, maybe about 10 years ago, I became interested in Göbekli Tepe. I was invited to a party at John Anthony West's house. He and Robert Schock were talking about going to Göbekli Tepe to see it for themselves.
And where so, is that? Where is
this
that?
This is in southeastern Turkey, in the region of the Fertile Crescent. This is the area of the world where all of the, or many of the civilizing skills of human society make their first appearance. It's the first cultivated grains. It's the first domesticated animals, metallurgy, stonemasonry. All sorts of skills turn up in the same region at the same moment for no clear reason. So the Dogon say that they were instructed in these skills, and I wanted to be able to talk intelligently about the Göbekli Tepe site before I went to this party, so I did some research. At Göbekli Tepe, what you have are multiple sets of standing stones placed in circles that have beautiful carved images of animals, sometimes in low relief, sometimes in very high relief, that were deliberately buried around 10,000, sometime after 10,000 BC, and remained covered over until the 1990s.
Wow.
And now that they're being excavated, they're in pristine condition because they were deliberately and carefully covered over. They weren't,
right.
You know, people took care not to damage them as they bury them. So in trying to get a toehold into what those symbols were, you have, you know, all the classic animals that are associated with kings and gods, you know, the scorpions and the serpents and the bulls, vultures pictured on these pillars for no apparent reason. So I was trying to make sense of why they were there. I could see that most of the animals were animals that play a symbolic role in this creation tradition. There's symbolism associated with animals. For example, a rabbit, which has a habit of twitching, is associated with the concept of vibration in physics.
Mm.
There's some obvious characteristic of the animal that pertains to the thing that it represents. So that you can,
right.
Once you get in the mindset of it, you can sort of intuitively figure out what the symbolism might be. So I know that even though 10,000 BC is 7,000 years before we see the first written language, so there's no text to go to say what did these things represent, I know that as you go back, the farther back in time you go, the more commonality of language you have. And there's another feature of language called ultra-conserved words. This is a linguistic feature of language that words that are very important to the language tend to stay in the language for very long periods of time. So I went to a modern Turkish dictionary and discovered that the word tepe, which is one of the two words in the name Göbekli Tepe, the name of the site,
mm-hmm.
has about 25 different meanings in the modern Turkish language. Then I went to an Egyptian hieroglyphic dictionary and discovered that a dozen of those meanings, those same meanings, are associated with the word tepe in this ancient Egyptian dictionary.
Wow.
So that meant I could be confident that when people in the region of Turkey were saying the word tepe, they likely meant very many of the same things the ancient Egyptians meant.
Right.
Okay, so then I look up the names of all of the animals that are pictured, you know, one at a time, the animals that are pictured on these pillars at Göbekli Tepe in the Egyptian hieroglyphic dictionary, and I discover that they are all homonyms. They are words that are pronounced like important terms of the cosmology.
Hmm.
That when you say the word for a bull, you're expressing a term of cosmology because they're pronounced the same way. So from that, I could figure out that these were probably cosmological symbols, like a proto-written language.
Right.
That a hunter-gatherer could walk.
And that amuses me tremendously because essentially they're puns.
Right. Right.
And, you know, I consider punning one of my spiritual practices because it keeps you wondering what the multiple meanings of everything is.
That's right. And I've always leaned very, anybody who knows me will tell you to my fault that I lean a little too far towards puns.
Well, the other thing is in ancient Hebrew scriptures, there are many, many puns, which if you don't know the culture at the time and the history, you would never get. And so there are multiple meanings to scriptural passages that most people have no clue about.
Right. Now, there's a reason for that from my perspective. This was originally an oral tradition.
Yes.
It far preceded the appearance of written language. So relationships between words have to do with the way they're pronounced, not the way they're written.
Mm-hmm.
But each term of this, each important term of the symbolic tradition typically carries multiple meanings that are discrete from each other so that you can't guess the additional meanings by knowing one of the meanings. It's like if you, the Egyptian hidden god, his name Amen, also means to grasp or to hold firm or to establish. And same thing for the Dogon god, the counterpart god Amma, who's the hidden god, also, his name also means to grasp or to hold firm or to establish. If you go to Hebrew, the word amen at the end of a prayer means to establish.
Yep.
So there's commonality of language here, but those multiple meanings When you look, when they turn up in an Egyptian dictionary where words are written with glyphs, it's not obvious that they're the same word except for the fact that they're pronounced like each other. So they play out as if they were homonyms, not multiple meanings.
Right. Fascinating. This is so much fun.
Then I had to try writing this book, Point of Origin. The way the book came about, about 4 years ago, one day in July, I thought I was researching half a dozen different questions for different people about language. I very often will do this. And one morning, I happened to turn up the answers to all six questions in the same hour-long period, and they all resolved based on words from the same column on the same page of the hieroglyphic dictionary.
Wow.
And the seventh word in that column told me what one of the key symbolic images on one of these Göbekli Tepe pillars represents.
That must have been an amazing day.
Yes. So that was sort of my entry point into trying to write this book, Point of Origin. And the material for the book it normally takes me about a year and a half to write a book, but the material for this book fell out in about 3 months. Hmm. And it kept leading me to sources where the guy who wrote the source that I was referring to would talk about something as the point of origin of something. This is the point of origin of cultivated plants, or this is the point of origin of stone carving. But they kept using that same phrase, point of origin, point of origin, point of origin, to the point that when I submitted the manuscript to the publisher, I made a contingency, which I don't normally do. Mm. Publishers like to assign their own titles to book, but I set a contingency that if they wanted the manuscript, they needed to take the title that went with the material. And that I needed to be true to that title because it had turned up again and again and again so often.
Right, right, right.
So now the trick was how to carry any of this forward to the later traditions, because it looks like there's a connection, but we don't have any texts to work from to try to sort things out. But we do have features of language and we do have features of culture that allow us to make certain inferences. So the key came out of an ancient Egyptian name, an archaic Egyptian word that was a name for the region where Göbekli Tepe is, where it's situated.
Mm.
And that name pointed me to a word for deity in India. It was a word. Now it's Painu. It refers originally referred to a mouse, but it's a concept of deity, and that term Painu tied me into an archaic cult, a matriarchal fertility cult called the Shakti cult.
Yep.
The Shakti cult, nobody knows how old it is, but it's described as being from time immemorial. Nobody it goes back farther than anybody can remember.
One of the most ancient. Yeah.
Now, the icons of that cult include all of the symbolic elements that we see at Göbekli Tepe.
I love
even
it.
Even down to the name of Göbekli Tepe itself. Göbekli Tepe, one of the traditional translations that's given for the name is Pot Belly Hill. Nobody ever explains it. But a pot belly for the Shakti cult is a clay pot filled with water that represents a womb.
Right. I hate to interrupt you because this is so juicy, but
that's okay,
we're going. Yeah, no pun. but we have to go to the break. I want to make sure people know where to find you online.
Okay.
What's your website?
The easiest. There's a fan site. There's a LairdScranton.com fan site that has a contact form that will reach me. But really, the easiest place to find me is on Facebook. I'm the only Laird Scranton there, or you can go to my author page at simonandschuster.com or at innertraditions.com.
Terrific. Okay, so my guest tonight is Laird Scranton, whose recent book is Point of Origin, and this is so much fun. Oh, my goodness. So we will be back shortly unless we get taller. This is David Franklin Farkas, for the Farkas Files. The truth is in here somewhere. We're on Empower Radio, and don't go nowhere because we're going to have a whole lot more fun.
Listening to Empower Radio, an entire radio station devoted to your personal development, expanding your conscious awareness, and empowering positive change. Meet our hosts and listen online at EmpowerRadio.com, on iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Stitcher Radio, or iTunes, or download the Empower Radio app for your smartphone or tablet. It's free in the App Store, and it lets you listen to our shows and podcasts on demand. Empowering people, empowering change. Empower Radio, online at EmpowerRadio.com.
Hey everybody, this is Josh Groban. After so many years on the stage, one of my favorite things about music is its ability to inspire and nourish the soul. That's why I'm proud to work with Feeding America, an organization that inspires hope for families in need and helps nourish the 16 million kids in this country struggling with hunger. Every year, billions of pounds of excess food go to waste, while one in five children may be left not knowing where their next meal is coming from, or if it's even coming at all. Thankfully, the Feeding America nationwide network of food banks collects surplus food and helps deliver it to kids in need across the country. But they can't do it alone. Join me in supporting Feeding America and your local food bank at feedingamerica.org. Together, we can solve hunger. Together, we're Feeding America.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
You wanted to see me?
Yes, please, have a seat. So here's the thing. When this company brought you on, we took a chance on you. You didn't have that four-year college degree we typically look for.
Right.
But we gave you a shot anyway. And since then, you've worked incredibly hard and given it your all.
Thanks.
You've been an important asset to the team, but I don't think you can be an intern here anymore. We want to hire you.
You're serious?
Absolutely.
Find your next great employee. Introduce yourself to the grads of life. Who are they? Talent worth knowing about. Young adults of unique determination and experience. An ideal fit for your company in an entry-level position, internship, or even mentorship. They might not have every qualification you typically look for, but they're exactly who your company needs.
I won't let you down.
I know.
Don't miss out on a resource many innovative companies have already discovered. Go to gradsoflife.org to learn how to find, cultivate, and train this great pool of untapped talent. Brought to you by the Ad Council and gradsoflife.org.
Today in school, I learned a lot. In chemistry, I learned that no one likes me. In biology, I learned that I'm fat and stupid. In English, I learned that I'm disgusting. And in gym, I learned that I'm pathetic and a joke. The only thing I didn't learn in school today is why no one ever helps.
Kids witness bullying every day. They want to help, but they don't know how. Teach them how to stop bullying and be more than a bystander at stopbullying.gov. A message from the Ad Council.
Smile. You found Empower Radio.
Now back to the Farkas Files with David Franklin Farkas on Empower Radio.
And we're back with Laird Scranton, author of, among other books, Point of Origin. And I'm sorry I had to interrupt you about the Shakti cult. That was...
I'm sorry. I drone on. Anybody worth their salt in this field can talk until next Sunday if you don't interrupt them.
Right, which is a good thing. because it's fascinating information. Briefly before the show, I mentioned to you that I've noticed patterns in spiritual traditions, and I'm curious whether you've noticed the same things or whether they will pique your curiosity. As someone who practiced yoga for quite a while and studied a bit of the Hindu tradition, it struck me at some point that many of the personal rituals in Catholicism are taken almost directly, if not directly, from Hindu practices. So the rosary and counting beads while repeating prayers is basically a mala, which is for the same purpose in Hindu tradition, saying mantras and counting how many times you say the mantra. Sitting, lighting candles and sitting staring at the candles is a meditation practice in Hinduism and is part of personal prayer in Catholicism. And sitting in front of a statue of a deity and calling upon the energy and the power of that deity happens in both as well. So whether it's a statue of Mary or an archangel or whatever it happens to be in the Catholic tradition, or all of the many deities in Hindu tradition, whether it's Ganesh or Shakti or whoever that particular temple has statues for, it basically the way it's used in personal practice is exactly the same. And it also struck me that almost every tradition, no matter what they're calling the things, has certain personalities. So Archangel Michael shows up in every religion I've ever looked at.
That's essentially the same kind of work that I do all the time. It's, mm-hmm. it's finding that those sets of connections that can't possibly be coincidental because you have too many points of overlap.
Right. Right. And of course, I think it would probably be mostly the later tradition would not notice it and would probably say, no, it couldn't be, you know, the rosary has nothing to do with Hindu tradition. They would be shocked. And, so that's part of my fascination with what you're doing is I've noticed around the edges, you know, without doing the kind of depth research you've done, I've noticed some things and scratched my head.
Well, the path for transmission, there's several different paths of transmission here, but the one that we're pursuing in point of origin begins in Turkey at 10,000 BC, southeastern mm-hmm. Turkey and western Iran at 10,000 BC, and it moves to the south and to the south and east down through India. The Shakti cult is understood to be foundational to the Vedic tradition, the Buddhist tradition, and the Hindu mm-hmm. tradition. And it looks to me, based on other evidence, that at around 6,000 BC, in that same Fertile Crescent region, you start getting a spread of tradition to all different places. And so as far away as in New Zealand, you end up with references that look for all the world like they're Hindu references, but with no indication of there was ever any representation of any of the Hindu gods. But they've got all these mm-hmm. other things of the sort of things you're talking about that are seem to be signatures of Hinduism.
Right.
On Orkney Island in the United Kingdom, in northern Scotland, you've got three or four different genetically linked connections that are unique to Orkney Island in the UK. But they link to 6,000 BC in the Fertile Crescent. There's a variety of barley that is grown on Orkney Island that was genetically first appeared in the Fertile Crescent at 6,000 BC. There's a variety of sheep. I don't have genetic tests to prove it yet, but I imagine that there's a variety of a vole. It's like a mouse.
Mm-hmm.
I talked earlier about the mouse being a concept of deity. You could trace that vole down through Palestine, and then it sort of jumps to northern Africa, and then it jumps to Orkney Island, and those are the only places this vole exists, in these three widespread places. It's as if somebody came by boat down the coastline, landed on the tip of the highest point of northern Africa, and then continued on to Orkney. In New Zealand, you find a bell, a metal bell with Tamil words written on it.
Wow. this smacks of so many science fiction stories where there is some artifact that nobody understands, but it has tremendous meaning, and it's from whatever their foundational myth is. And either the modern people look at it and know what it says, or, you know, at some point in the story it unfolds and you figure it out. I just watched Cloud Atlas, which is about reincarnation and karma. And there are all kinds of cross-references like that that don't come together until the last couple of scenes.
Right. I love when that film is put together that way.
Oh, God, it's such a good movie. It's like...
The film Arrival was out this year, does similar things.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. Cloud Atlas is like watching 9 movies simultaneously. It's just incredible.
Just this week, one of the things that I've been actively working on that has come together is on Orkney in northern Scotland, in an era during the 2000 BC periods of time, there were burial traditions on Orkney. They came across these group burials where they could see that it looks like there was warfare going on, because the heads, the skulls of the, first of all, the bodies have been dismembered, the bones broken up, and the skulls have damage to the top of the head. That looks like they were hit by an axe or something, and they thought,
right. Wow,
it's not clear if they were killed by that blow, but they probably died as a result of it. The traditional researchers in the UK look at it that way. What they don't understand is all of the facets of the burial chamber, where it's located, why it's set there, how the bones are placed in the chamber, the skulls being separated from the bones, the damage to the top of the skulls, is all part of a documented Shakti cult ritual that happened around 6000 BC in the region I'm talking about. So you've got those kinds of connections, and without a broad perspective of what happens in different cultures, you don't recognize it as being something.
Right. Right. Even if the details and nuances are not there, you don't know all of that. If you know the tradition and what the tradition did, what it looked like, that kind of thing, you can start seeing the patterns.
Right.
I also find that the connection to Judaism fascinating, because that pops up all over Africa in fascinating ways.
Yeah, many of the Dogon words that I equate to ancient Egyptian words are also Hebrew words.
Mm-hmm.
But that makes sense, because the Dogon are wearing prayer shawls and skull caps and circumcising and celebrating a Jubilee year just like the Jews do.
And that was in what time period?
Well, it looked, the Dogon looked like to me as if they were Egyptian at 3000 BC and have preserved, very carefully preserved, cultural traditions, rituals, words, myths for thousands of years.
Wow. Well, I knew about some of the African groups in East Africa that were basically completely Jewish, with, you know, prayer shawls, skull caps, prayers, most of it in recognizable Hebrew,
right.
And liturgy that was Hebrew, was Jewish. But I didn't know that it was in West Africa.
Yeah, so. Well, the Dogon have migrated. They believe that they originated far to the east.
They have
memory of an ancestral homeland along a large lake far to the east of where they live now.
Ah, okay. Yeah, it's that whole lost tribes thing, but bigger than that, probably.
Yeah.
So this is an extraordinary path that you're on, because obviously you're not done. What's the next thread that you're yanking on in this tapestry?
Well, my series of books basically moved geographically from Africa to Egypt to India to Tibet and China, then to Turkey, then on to the United Kingdom. And tracing the same path of transmission, the next place it goes is New Zealand. And along the way, it seems to stop at various places in the Americas and Polynesia.
Mind-boggling.
So the next page is a book about, it's called Decoding Maori Cosmology. It'll be out sometime, probably May next year.
Wow.
But it's all the same stuff, all the same symbolic references, same priestly traditions. As a matter of fact, I had originally planned to write the Maori book as my second book, but other material kept bumping it. Every time I finish up a book, I go back to the Maori book and say, okay, now I'm going to write the Maori book, and it would get bumped again.
Right.
Now I finally get around to writing it, and I realize that the Maori language that I'm working with, a comparative Maori Polynesian dictionary, and working just from that dictionary, I could make positive connections to every culture and every era that I've written about.
Wow.
And I wouldn't have recognized them if I'd written a second.
Right. Right. Yeah, it works that way. Good. Spirit pushes you around so you get in the right sequence. Yeah,
you
I've always been...
You got to be pushable, you know?
or draggable.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've always been curious about the Maori tattoos and other symbols that have shapes that are reminiscent of all kinds of other cultures.
Yep.
As I close my eyes now, I'm thinking Hindu, but I'm sure there are more.
Right. Now, the archaic philosophy that all this stuff comes out of is called, there's a pair of philosophies that go together. One is cosmological. It's called Samkhya. And it's a companion to yoga.
Mm.
Yoga is the sort of the personal implementation of the same cosmological concepts. There's parallelism in these processes of creation. The Dogons see three themes of cosmology as being parallel: how the universe formed, how matter forms, and how biological reproduction happens. And that those processes are so parallel that they simultaneously describe all three processes using one progression of symbols.
Wow.
Now, what that means is that it's not really legitimate to ask, what does this symbol represent? You have to ask, what does it represent if we're talking about biology, and what does it represent if we're talking about how matter forms? There are,
right,
are subtle differences, parallel symbolism, but subtle differences.
That's incredible. That's totally amazing.
I feel like somebody was just showing off when they did that.
Well, or they were being very sophisticated in reusing things and reminding people that things are parallel.
Actually, what I think they were doing is they were establishing credentials for themselves, because there's a huge swath of this that lines up with our science, so we can verify this parallelism. You can point across, you know, side by side, you got to match all the way up. But there's another piece of this that runs so deep that we don't have a current way to verify, to positively verify that what they're talking about is correct. But because we have this other huge piece that sits on top of it that we can verify, any thinking person says, well, they were right about all the rest of this stuff. I should at least consider whether they're right about the other piece.
Do they have an explanation for dark energy and dark matter?
Actually, there is. There is an explanation for the things that we can't see. This mindset that comes out of the archaic Samkhya philosophy is that universes form in pairs routinely, that ours is the fourth of seven pairs of universes, that are one is non-material or less material, and the other one is material. The non-material is considered to be feminine, and the material is considered to be masculine. And there's a cycle of energy between these universes that is as essential to life in the universe as the natural water cycle is, the motion of water evaporating to form clouds that create rain that run back to the sea. If you didn't have this scrolling energy between these two universes, this cycle of energy, you wouldn't have life.
Right.
And the non-material is characterized as having perfect knowledge, but an inability to act. And the material has perfect ability to act, but imperfect knowledge. And so there are all these routine attempts being made, according to Samkhya, to try to, you know, from the non-material side, to try to induce either to communicate knowledge or to induce action on the material side. And those come in the form of what we would see as coincidences, the unusual behavior of animals, clairvoyance, divination,
right.
All the sorts of psychological or paranormal fields of study that we can't put our finger on. Is this real or is it not real?
So does the Dogen tradition have a version of shamanism?
Yes, the Dogen have diviners and shaman. Shamanism plays a role, but not the dominant role. The Dogen priests, who are called Hogan, H-O-G-O-N, mm-hmm. come out of the yoga tradition. They were a tradition that started out matriarchal in archaic times. Like many other aspects of this ancient cosmology, there's symbolic reversal that happens after a period of time. And so things that were matriarchal become patriarchal.
Right.
So the male priests for the Dogen now are counterparts to the female yoginis that taught the same kind of world cosmology and so forth back in ancient times.
The reason I was asking is that sense of there being a physical and non-physical with a communication between the two of them is a core aspect of shamanism, that you go between the worlds and that you do things in the non-physical that then affect the physical. And so this is the oldest story that I've heard that explains it, and it's a very elegant explanation and very much like all the indigenous shamanism traditions explaining going into another dimension.
Right.
So
now my role in all this is I take the stance that we want to entertain the idea that what we're being told is true. And so I take the statements that these cultures give us, and then I try to ask whether there's a perspective from which this could be a rational statement. When the Dogen say there are two universes, one non-material that we can't see and the other one material, is there any perspective from which we might think that's true? Well, there actually is. There's a scientific perspective from which it's true. There are more than 200 fundamental particles. The Dogen say 266. They're much more specific. But these fundamental particles are classed by physicists and by the Dogen priests into four different groupings based on the symmetry of the particle, what it looks like from different sides. And so there's one kind that looks the same from all sides, another kind that has to be turned halfway around to look the same, another kind that has to be turned all the way around to look the same, and a fourth mysterious kind that has to be turned around twice to look the same. And the one that turns around twice is the one that has the potential to be passing into and out of, it's kind of a blind spot, like the blind spot created by the mirrors on your car.
Right. And, you know, if they had any kind of shamanic priesthood, then there were people within their tradition that experienced that there was a non-physical dimension that could be experienced, contacted, that there were things there that you could communicate with.
Right. And there are different ways of communicating also. The Kabbalism, they have a whole long list of categories of mystics, different styles of mystics who facilitate that communication in different ways. You know, there's the Edgar Cayces who have to go into a trance to learn something.
Right.
And there are a whole range of different ways that people, you know, some people have to use ayahuasca to get it.
Right. The equatorial traditions tend to require a trance-like possession state. And that winds up going through a wide swath of Africa and the Caribbean, and I don't know if it goes through Asia.
But the bottom line, from what I see, is that there's only one requirement to getting that information, and that is allowing for the possibility that it might actually be real.
Yes.
That
exactly.
By when you allow for that, realizing it's something that Dogen called discriminating knowledge. You know, when you're you see 11:11 twice a day, that might have significance, but it also might simply be that you don't credit any other time of day. You don't notice it. You don't make note of it. You don't remember if you saw 12:23 three times that day.
Right.
But so asking the question, could this be something more than coincidence, tends to draw that kind of thing to you. And the better you get at distinguishing between the things that do represent something and the things that don't, is sort of the fostering of this communication.
Yeah, absolutely. That's true in all the explanations I've ever heard. So, Laird, we just have a couple more minutes, and obviously we could keep talking all night, which is delightful. What do you want to leave people with? What do you want people to be thinking about in all of this?
Well, a couple of principles that I follow in all of this for myself. I had to ask some serious questions, and I realized the kind of material I was working with, whether I even had a right to write about it. Here's a body of material that was deliberately kept, very mm-hmm. closely held secret for thousands of years. What business
right.
do I have writing about it? But on a go-forward basis, we've got to treat this material, first of all, as being non-proprietary. This is information that as much belongs to everybody on the planet as a seed that falls from a tree or a plant, or water that falls from the sky. Anybody mm-hmm. who tries to say they own the water that falls from the sky, that contradicts everything about the way humanity ought to work from my perspective. This material can't be treated as proprietary. It needs to be treated as it belongs to everybody. The second thing is that each person needs to do what they can. My wife, Risa, tells a fable about a knight who was riding along on a horse along a road. And as he's riding, he notices lying by the side of the road is a little sparrow with his feet, little spindly feet stuck up in the air, lying on his back. And then the knight stops and says, "Sparrow, why are you lying on your back with your feet stuck up in the air?" And the sparrow says, "Well, I'm holding up the sky."
Mm-hmm.
And the knight starts to laugh. He says, "How can you possibly think those two little spindly feet could hold up the sky?" And the sparrow says, "One does what one can." That's really the ultimate message I would want to leave people with, is each person does what they can, we've got it solved.
Perfect. Laird, thanks so much for being on the show, and I hope you'll come back. This is way too much fun to end here.
Well, I would love to come back sometime. Thank you very much for having me.
Excellent. My guest tonight is Laird Scranton. You can find him on Facebook, on various websites. Just Google Laird Scranton. Thanks so much. This has been great fun. And if any of you are curious, who is this guy, Dave, and what in the world does he do? You can go to househealing.com, and there's every conceivable way to get in touch with me, including a link to schedule a 20-minute free phone consultation to assess how my work might be helpful to you with a person, place, situation, business, whatever it might be. Information about the show, including the entire archive of the last 6 years of interviews, is at thefarkasfiles.com, and you can listen from there, from empowerradio.com, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, iTunes podcasts, and of course the Empower Radio app for either flavor of smartphone or tablet. And that's the easiest way, because you can just click on any of the shows and see all of the archive and choose what you want to listen to. Very cool technology that we've got now. So thank you so much for spending some of your time with me. I hope you're having fun, because this would be silly to do if you weren't. Thank you, one and all, for being with us wherever you are, whenever you are. This is David Franklin Farkas for the Farkas Files. The truth is in here somewhere on Empower Radio. Have a fantastic week.